Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Americas. Trump threatens 50% Brazil tariffs, citing Bolsonaro trial. Prospective levy as highest yet in president's flurry of letters to world leaders on trade. By Gavin Bade and Samantha Pearson. The U.S. will charge a 50% tariff on Brazilian goods starting on August 1st, President Trump announced in a letter to the Latin American country's government on Wednesday, citing legal action against its former president Jair Bolsonaro and U.S. tech firms as justification for the levies. The 50% tariff is the highest level announced so far in Trump's flurry of letters to world leaders this week, which were sent after he pushed back the deadline to impose his so-called reciprocal tariffs to August 1st. They had previously been set to take effect on Wednesday, after being paused since April. Trump also announced on social media Wednesday night that he'll impose a 50% tariff on global imports of copper, beginning on August 1st. Trump wrote that he had received a national security report underlining the importance of copper. Bolsonaro, the leader of Brazil's political right and a longtime Trump ally, is on trial in Brazil over an alleged coup attempt against the sitting government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a legal case that Trump sharply criticized in his tariff letter to da Silva. The way that Brazil has treated former President Bolsonaro, a highly respected leader throughout the world during his term, including by the United States, is an international disgrace, Trump said in the letter posted to his Truth Social platform. Trump wrote a lengthy message in support of Bolsonaro on Monday on Truth Social, calling the criminal case a politically motivated witch hunt against the conservative leader by Brazil's Supreme Court and drawing parallels with his own legal problems. This is nothing more or less than an attack on a political opponent, something I know much about. Leave Bolsonaro alone, Trump wrote. Unlike Trump's other reciprocal tariffs, the letter outlining the levies explicitly cited his support for an embattled political ally and criticism of the government that is putting him on trial. Bolsonaro told the Wall Street Journal in November last year that he was banking on Trump to use economic sanctions against da Silva's government to help him return to power in Brazil, where he also faces an electoral ban that prevents him from running for office until 2030. Trump's administration has been locked in a dispute with Brazil's Supreme Court over moves by Justice Alexandre de Moraes to stamp out what he says is hate speech by Brazil's far right, both at home and in the U.S. Elon Musk labeled de Moraes a dictator last year after the justice shut down his X platform for more than a month in the country. Trump's media company, the parent of Truth Social, and video sharing platform Rumble also sued de Moraes earlier this year, accusing him of illegally censoring political discourse on social media in the U.S. Da Silva and de Moraes have said that they would do what it takes to protect the country's young democracy after thousands of supporters of Bolsonaro stormed the country's capital in violent riots on January 8, 2023, drawing comparisons with the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol in the U.S. The defense of democracy in Brazil is a matter for Brazilians, da Silva said Monday, after Trump's message of support for Bolsonaro. We are a sovereign country. We do not accept interference or tutelage from anyone. The tariff levels for Brazil could ultimately go higher, according to Wednesday's letter. In response to Brazilian legal cases and fines on U.S. tech firms, Trump wrote that he has directed the U.S. Trade Representative's office to open a tariff investigation into unfair trade practices in Brazil under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. That could mean additional levies on top of the so-called reciprocal rate of 50%. The 50% tariff would be a major disruption to $92 billion trade in goods with Brazil, a country with which the U.S. ran a trade surplus of $7.4 billion in 2024, according to the Trade Representative's Office. Brazil is the U.S.'s 16th largest trading partner, according to the Census Bureau, and the U.S. exported $49.7 billion to the country in 2024, while importing $42.3 billion. Brazil's currency, the real, lost more than 2% against the dollar late Wednesday after Trump's announcement. Trump and his team have focused on reducing trade deficits in negotiations with many other nations, and his letter to Brazil references trade deficits as a national security threat, despite the fact that the U.S. runs a surplus with the country. Please understand that these tariffs are necessary to correct the many years of Brazil's tariff and non-tariff policies and trade barriers causing these unsustainable trade deficits against the United States, he wrote. But much of his letter to Brazil focused on the treatment of Bolsonaro, who he befriended during his first term as both heads of state sought to push their nations politically to the right, and U.S. tech firms. The tariffs, he wrote, would be based on Brazil's insidious attacks on free elections and the fundamental free speech rights of Americans, referring to U.S.-based social media platforms. U.S. dollar far from dead as reserve managers buy up. Claims that the U.S. dollar's role as the world's reserve currency is ending might be misplaced. Data from the International Monetary Fund for Q1 shows an increase of $168 billion in total reserves globally. Of this, 54% was in U.S. dollars. During past episodes of pressure, U.S. dollar accumulation seemed intended by reserve managers to prevent even sharper appreciation in their local currencies, says Steve Englander, global head of Forex research at Standard Chartered. Reserve managers may also have been buying U.S. dollars when it was cheap. They may also have felt a need to accumulate U.S. dollar reserves in anticipation of more asset market turbulence, he added. Singapore dollar strengthens slightly as risk appetite stabilizes. The Singapore dollar strengthens slightly against its U.S. counterpart in the Asian session as risk appetite stabilizes. The VIX Volatility Index, or so-called Wall Street's fear gauge, fell to 15.9 on Wednesday, its lowest level since February. DBS Group Research's Philip Wee says in a commentary. Investors shrugged off President Trump's warning that there would be no tariff extension beyond the August 1 deadline as trade rhetoric, the senior FX strategist says. However, we remain wary of Trump's threat to impose a 200% tariff on the pharmaceutical sector, Wee adds. U.S. dollar / Singapore dollar is 0.1% lower at 1.2788. Yen strengthens amid worries over U.S. tariffs. The yen strengthens against other G10 and Asian currencies in the early morning session amid worries over U.S. tariffs. President Trump announced in a letter to Brazil's government on Wednesday that the U.S. will charge a 50% tariff on Brazilian goods starting August 1. The 50% tariff is the highest unveiled so far amid Trump's wave of letters to world leaders this week. The yen is drawing renewed safe haven demands, StoneX's Matt Simpson says in commentary. Tariff risks and geopolitical tensions have returned to the spotlight, the senior market analyst said. U.S. dollar JPY falls 0.3% to 145.84, and AUD / JPY is 0.2% lower at 95.48, according to FactSet. Israel's agonizing choice over which hostages to save. The current deal on the table would see 10 men released out of 20 believed to be alive, by Anat Peled. Only 20 of the hostages Hamas is holding in Gaza are believed to be alive. A ceasefire deal being negotiated is expected to bring an agonizing choice over who to free. Israel can only pick 10. It's Schindler's List, said Anat Angrest, the mother of captive soldier Matan Angrest, 22, who said her son was injured. I don't understand how the state can choose who should stay in hell. Israel and Hamas are now hammering out a deal that would see the release of 10 living hostages and the bodies of 18 others in exchange for a 60-day ceasefire and the release of Palestinian prisoners held in Israel, a deal appears to be closer than at any point in recent months. In two previous ceasefire rounds, the decisions, while painful, were easier to rationalize in some ways. Priority was given to civilian women, children, and the elderly. Next in line were female soldiers or men who were injured. Now, all of the living hostages are men, and they are likely to be in a deteriorating mental and physical state. For the families still waiting, the decision is creating deep despair. The Israeli Prime Minister's office didn't respond to a request for comment about how it chooses which hostages should be released. Elie David knows that his brother Eyatar David, 24, who was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival, is likely not a top priority for release as he is young and uninjured, even if he faces harsh conditions in captivity. We understood early on that Eviatar was never going to be among the first, David said. But for Eviatar to be left behind again would shatter him, he said. This knowledge that your brother is still there, still suffering, is really unbearable. I pray that we won't reach a situation where he is left there. Hostage families have insisted that any deal should include the release of all hostages at once rather than in phases. Many families are angry at the Israeli government over the partial deals it has negotiated. Hamas said it would release all the hostages in exchange for an end to the war, something Israel refuses to do until the group is defeated. By insisting on choosing partial deals, the Israeli government has created with its own hands the system of selection, said the Hostages and Missing Families Forum, a group that represents most of the families. In addition to the 20 men Israel believes to be alive, there are also two men whom Israel has said it has severe concern for their lives, language typically used by the military when hostages are likely to be deceased, but haven't yet been declared dead. There are also 28 bodies of hostages that are being held in the Gaza Strip. For hostage families, the impending deal is fostering a sense of panic over whether their loved ones will make it onto the list. The inclusion of one hostage means another one won't make it out, making any choice a painful outcome for families who have bonded and lobbied the world together over 21 months of war. Maccabit Meir, whose twin nephews, Gali and Ziv Berman, 27, are being held in Gaza, says she can't sleep. She closes her eyes but finds herself in a state of constant tension, ready to grab her phone or turn on the television for breaking news. Her heart beats faster and she dreads a phone call informing her of the worst. It's like a nightmare you just can't wake up from, Mayer said. Everyone is in a very extreme situation, she said, referring to hostage families waiting to see if they will make the list. While the exact criteria for inclusion on the list are still unclear, there is speculation it could include the injured, wounded, or men with children, say people close to the families. Many hostage families are emphasizing the poor medical condition of their relatives in interviews, and some are compiling medical files in hopes it could influence authorities. But some medical professionals say that giving priority to the most vulnerable after 21 months will prove professionally impossible because of limited information and ethical implications. I really don't think that the medical teams at this point in time can determine who is more at risk and who is less at risk, said Haggai Levine, a doctor who heads the health team for the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. Levine, who has compiled medical files for each hostage since the start of the war, says there isn't up-to-date information on the precise medical state of each hostage and that he relies on released hostages' testimony and Hamas videos. It's like treating a patient with a heart disease based on his EKG from 3 months ago, he said. In recent days, Aniv Zakarkar, whose son Matan, 25, was kidnapped from a kibbutz, met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife Sarah, whom she hugged. It was a surprising display of affection toward the Netanyahus. Zagakar has become one of the Prime Minister's fiercest critics over his refusal to end the war for the release of all hostages. She later said that Netanyahu had assured her in the meeting he would free all the hostages. She declined to comment for this article. The deal being discussed in Doha includes a stipulation that the two sides are supposed to immediately enter into negotiations for a second stage that would end the war and free the remaining hostages. Some fear the second stage will never come. A previous ceasefire deal earlier this year never reached a second stage after Israel resumed fighting in the enclave. Hamas has sought stronger guarantees from mediators than talks will proceed to an end for the war, something Israel has so far refused. Parents of soldiers held in Gaza are especially worried because they have heard from released hostages that soldiers are treated worse than civilians and face violence and interrogations by militants. Previous ceasefire deals place soldiers in the last category for release. They fear they could be left for last. Out of the 20, two were soldiers captured in uniform. Some families of soldiers say they feel betrayed by their government because it failed to protect their loved ones during the October 7, 2023, Hamas-led attacks that started the war and now could be leaving them behind again. Idan Alexander, an American Israeli citizen, is the only soldier captured in uniform who has so far been freed in a deal. That deal was between the U.S. and Hamas and didn't include Israel. In Israel, where military service is mandatory at age 18, many Israelis believe that the oath taken by a soldier to protect the state means the country will do everything to protect him in return. My Matan is a soldier, and our country didn't fight for the soldiers as part of the deals, Ingris said. This contract has been broken. World. The drone factories fueling Russia's unprecedented assaults on Ukraine. The latest assault included more drones in a single night than Russia used in an entire month last year, by Matthew Luxmore and Jane Litvinenko. Russia's factories have begun churning out vast quantities of attack drones over the past year, producing a deadly fleet that is now taking to Ukrainian skies in record numbers almost daily. An assault Wednesday was the largest yet, according to Ukrainian officials. In the early morning hours, Russia launched 728 drones and decoy munitions at cities in western Ukraine. The attacks came just hours after President Trump blasted Russia for dragging its feet over peace talks to end the war, saying the U.S. gets a lot of balls from Russian Vladimir Putin. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky said the attack showed again that Russia has no desire to end the war. At a time like this, when so much has been done to achieve peace and a ceasefire, and only Russia is rebuffing them all, he said on social media. The attacks are often targeted at Ukrainian military sites and at getting Ukraine to use up its interceptor drones. Ukraine said its air defenses drowned most of the drones in Wednesday's attack, and the damage, which included several warehouses in western Ukraine, was limited. But the attacks have also killed many civilians and have contributed to a sense of siege in Ukraine's cities and towns, where air raid sirens are sending people to bomb shelters in parts of Ukraine almost nightly. More than 24,000 drones have barreled toward Ukraine's towns and cities since the start of this year, according to an analysis of Ukrainian figures by the Center for Information Resilience, a UK-based open-source investigations organization. Wednesday's attack included more drones in a single night than in the entire month of July last year. They're constantly beating new records, said Yuri Inhot, a spokesman for Ukraine's Air Force. Many of the largest attacks have come amid rising tensions between Russia and the U.S. Russia hit an earlier record in recent days after a call between Trump and Putin, which led the U.S. president to say he was disappointed in the Russian leader for being unwilling to halt the war. Moscow on Wednesday tried to play down Trump's latest comments, which were made during a cabinet meeting the previous day, and included saying that a lot of what the Russian leader said turned out to be meaningless. "We are fairly calm about this," Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Wednesday of Trump's criticism of Putin. What paved the way for the unprecedented scale of Wednesday's drone attacks was an agreement Russia signed in November 2022 with Iran to purchase and produce Iran's Shahed attack drones on Russian territory. Russia paid $1.75 billion for the Shahed technology, equipment, source code, and 6,000 drones, according to a recent report from C4ADS, a nonprofit organization researching illicit networks worldwide. At the time, Moscow had expended much of its long-range rocket stocks in the course of that year, and the effective but cheap Iranian drones offered an alternative solution, enabling Moscow to continue its aerial assaults. Estimates vary widely on how much it costs Russia to produce a single Shahed drone, with defense analysts putting it anywhere from $35,000 to $60,000. The initial models were shipped directly from Iran, but Russia also paid for the technology and, over time, mastered the different elements of the production chain. In Tatarstan, east of Moscow, facilities inside the Alabuga Special Economic Zone expanded to accommodate the requirements of drone manufacture. Alabuga drew on Chinese components, a workforce that included cheap laborers hired from Africa, and the logistics networks that Iran had honed during its own years-long standoff with the West. Ukrainian drones have struck the facility several times, but Russia has managed to continue the work. Intelligence officials in Kyiv say it has since outsourced parts of it to other facilities across the country. For Russia, making drones locally has been a way of reducing its reliance on Iran, a prescient decision in light of Israel's bombardment of Iran last month and the depletion of Iran's own drone stocks through retaliatory attacks on Israel. Moscow's adaptations have also improved on Iran's original design, making them faster and quieter. That has increased their maneuverability and helped maximize damage. Ukrainian officials say Russia is now producing more than 5,000 of the long-range drones and decoys each month, with some able to fly 2,500 kilometers to their target. That has allowed Moscow to saturate Ukraine's skies with the flying machines. Ukraine meets the threat by scrambling jet fighters and helicopters, deploying electronic jamming and mobile air defense teams on the ground and, increasingly, drones tasked with intercepting the Russian munitions hurtling through the sky. "We're using all the resources at our disposal," said Anat, the Air Force spokesman. At the same time, Russia is regularly changing its own tactics to wreak maximum havoc. Russia's goal is to force Ukraine to expend valuable interceptor missiles and bringing down decoy drones, which resemble ordinary Shahed drones in appearance but carry no payload. Russia deploys hundreds of these imitator drones to distract Ukraine's air defenses from the real threat, Kyiv says. Ukrainian air defenses are, in turn, getting better at identifying these decoys, noting subtle differences in their sound appearance and flight path, Anat says. He said Ukraine aims to disable them using only electronic warfare, dialing into the radio frequency that guides them. Drone attack have been two-way traffic. Moscow has said that Ukraine is launching dozens of its own munitions at Russian territory each day, alleging that some of the projectiles strike civilian areas. Authorities in Russia's Kursk said three civilians were killed and seven injured in a drone strike on a beach in the city Tuesday night. A video published by Russian law enforcement showed an official sifting through what he said was the wreckage of a destroyed drone. Climate and environment. Why America still can't get disaster alerts right. Residents increasingly tune out phone messages about floods and fires if the alerts make it to them at all. Drew Fitzgerald, Josie Wright, and Caitlin Ostroff. America's emergency warning infrastructure still isn't getting enough people out of harm's way. Federal, state, and local authorities share responsibility for alerting citizens that they are in danger. But despite continued technological advances, the country's patchwork of digital and physical emergency alert tools is often a step behind Mother Nature with deadly consequences. There were repeated flash flooding warnings in Kerr County, Texas, as rain moved in and the Guadalupe River surged at the start of the July 4th weekend. Those alerts never reached some of the campers and residents who lacked cell phone service, silence notifications, or didn't have phones with them, and outdoor sirens were considered but never built. More than 100 people died. Earlier this year, some fire evacuations warnings in the Altadena neighborhood of Los Angeles arrived too late, and 17 people lost lives. Los Angeles County also mistakenly sent an evacuation warning to cell phones in the wrong areas during the January wildfires. Across the Pacific, Maui's outdoor sirens never sounded 2 years ago when deadly wildfires approached the edge of the Hawaiian island. Local authorities realized too late that wireless alerts couldn't reach residents over cell phone networks that failed during the fast-moving blaze. How it works. Emergency alerts come from a host of agencies and are distributed on a wide range of platforms, from wireless messages and push alerts to social media and sirens. Federal and local authorities can blast warnings to TV and radio audiences through the emergency alert system. The separate wireless emergency alert system notifies cell phone users based on their location. Residents can also sign up for urgent warnings delivered directly from local authorities by app, email, or text message. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's internet-based alert system has made it easier for local authorities to reach residents. But industry experts say some rural officials often lack the funding, expertise, or permission from state authorities to push their own alerts through broadcasters and cell phones. A lot of places are afraid to push that button, said Brian Tulin, Vice President of Public Safety at software provider Everbridge. Alert fatigue. U.S. authorities caution that too many warnings can cause cell phone users to shut off notifications that become bothersome or irrelevant. A menu of warnings for floods, fires, missing children, and more have caused alert fatigue in some areas. A 2024 RAND report found Texas cell phone users opted out of wireless emergency alerts at the highest rate. Nearly 30% of Texans chose to turn off at least one kind of wireless alert, a choice researchers partly attributed to exhaustion from the large number of statewide alerts. Some of the ways authorities alert people to emergencies. Wireless emergency alerts, WEA, notify people within range of predetermined cell towers via text message. Emergency alert systems, EAS, broadcast messages to TVs and radios within a specific area. NOAA, Weather Radio, NWR, is a network of radio stations broadcasting continuous weather information. Social media and mobile applications can notify people with posts and push alerts. People can be warned by outdoor sirens or officials going door to door. One statewide alert last October about a man wanted for allegedly shooting a police chief in the Texas Panhandle went out before 5 a.m., prompting thousands of complaints to the Federal Communications Commission. Human mishaps can also erode trust. Florida officials in 2023 apologized after an early morning test of a TV alert instead blared through cell phones statewide because an official had checked the wrong box. The FCC is working on changes that would let authorities send muted or vibrate-only notifications in less dire situations. Those changes won't go into effect until 2028. Other countries have refined their alert systems to reduce unnecessary alerts. Israel's advanced radar system discerns whether rockets are likely to hit unpopulated or crowded areas, and its civilian warning systems are precisely targeted. Flooding challenges. Flash flooding is especially hard to predict and warnings often cover broad areas, said Upmanu Lal, director of water research centers at Columbia University and Arizona State University. Some people who have received repeated alerts but don't see hazardous conditions assume they are false alarms. The National Weather Service in the Austin-San Antonio area, which covers Kerr County, had issued more than a dozen flash flood warnings in May and June, according to a journal analysis of FEMA emergency alert data. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now continuing on with our article. Over the July 4th weekend, the National Weather Service posted warnings about affected areas when its meteorologists noticed rainfall reaching dangerous levels. Kerr County received its first alert at 1:14 a.m., but the flooding rushed through the area while residents slept. Many victims were children and counselors away at summer camp without access to their phones. Lauren Tyler visited her parents during the holiday weekend high on a hill above the La Junta camp, where young boys nearly washed away. Her family slept through the alerts and lost power. They learned about the flood when the owner of the camp called to ask for help finding missing children in the area. The morning after the floods, Kerrville resident Don Frazier was sitting on his porch drinking coffee when he checked social media and noticed reports of nearby flooding. His phone had been set to do not disturb during the night, and he lives on higher ground. I was pretty dogbone oblivious to what was going on just a few miles up the river, said Frazier, the director of the Texas Center at Schreiner University. Policy: Trump names Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy as interim NASA chief. President's announcement come after he withdrew his nomination of entrepreneur Jared Isaacman as the agency's leader in May, by Micah Maidenberg. After pushing out his original nominee to run NASA, President Trump has found a temporary leader to run it, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. Trump said in a Truth Social post Wednesday evening that he was appointing Duffy to serve as interim administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He will be a fantastic leader of the ever more important space agency, even if only for a short period of time, he said. Duffy said on X he was honored to take on the role. He will continue serving in his role at the Transportation Department while he runs NASA. During his tenure leading the Transportation Department, Duffy has been leading with the aftermath of a mid-air collision in Washington that took 67 lives and has advocated for bolstering the U.S. air traffic control system. At NASA, he will face a different set of challenges. The agency has been in limbo since the president in May pulled support for Jared Isaacman, the first pick for NASA chief. Isaacman, a billionaire entrepreneur who traveled to orbit twice on SpaceX vehicles, was poised to win Senate confirmation for the NASA administrator job before Trump reversed course. In a Truth Social post Sunday, the president raised concerns about Isaacman's past political donations to Democrats and ties to Elon Musk, the billionaire SpaceX founder and chief executive who had been feuding with Trump. Isaacman said the president is entitled to build the team he believes will best serve his administration. He also said he has made donations to both parties and that his relationship with Musk was a professional one. It isn't clear how long Duffy will serve in his new role. At a town hall meeting in late June, NASA Chief of Staff Brian Hughes said the agency might not get a permanent leader for at least 6 months. NASA has since January been led by Acting Administrator Janet Petro, who had previously served as the top official for the agency's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The Trump administration has also sought major budget cuts that would reduce NASA's scientific programs, space operations, and workforce. The White House wanted to remake the Artemis Human Exploration Program, too, but Congress included funding to keep that effort going without major changes in the recent tax and budget bill. Duffy won't be the only Trump administration official wearing more than one hat. Marco Rubio was confirmed as Secretary of State, but is also serving in other positions, including as acting leader of the National Archives. Policy: the fight between Musk accolades and the White House for control of Doge. Elon Musk's allies are fighting for influence at Doge as the White House moves to neuter the office. By Shalini Ramachandran, Scott Patterson, and Catherine Long. Elon Musk has left the government, but his clout at Doge lives on. Weeks after the billionaire left his role at the Department of Government Efficiency, amid his feud with President Trump, a small band of Musk loyalists is fighting to preserve the legacy and power of the government-slashing office. Current and former officials close to Doge say that in closed meetings, staffers have been quizzed on questions of their loyalty, Trusk or Musk. The fight has pitted Doge officials against some in the White House who are seeking to diminish Doge's role, and has triggered infighting and paranoia within the group's diminished ranks, according to people familiar with the matter. Musk's influence continues to be felt at Doge largely through Steve Davis, who was his top lieutenant at Doge before leaving the government in May, according to some of those people. Despite no longer being a government employee, Davis continues to give directions to Doge officials regularly and has privately told some of them that his department was fake news, say people familiar with the conversations. An official close to Davis and Musk said Davis isn't giving directions and conversations with current Doge officials are informal. Some current and former Doge officials say allies of Musk want to finish the work they started and usher in a Doge 2.0 focused more on revamping government websites and information technology systems than cutting government workers. But others, including some inside the White House, say they believe Musk and Davis are keeping tentacles in government to help their businesses. During his time at Doge, Musk and his allies helped SpaceX, Tesla, and ex-employees get jobs across the government. A Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman said the agency has been testing Starlink connections in several states. Doge featured prominently in the early days of Trump's second term, but became a political headache for the White House after it failed to achieve the savings promised by Musk. Doge says it has saved $190 billion through a combination of asset sales, contract cancellations, job cuts, and other moves. Budget experts across the political spectrum question that claim. The tug of war over Doge carries risks for Musk, who has a large book of government contracts and is managing the plummeting fortunes of Tesla, his electric vehicle company. Trump told reporters last week that we might have to put Doge on Elon. You know what Doge is? Doge is the monster that might have to go back and eat Elon. Trump made the comments in response to Musk's recent criticism of Trump's sprawling tax and spending bill, which lawmakers passed and the president signed, and its contributions to the federal debt. On Saturday, Musk said he created a new political party called the America Party to challenge Republicans and Democrats. Musk and Davis didn't respond to requests for comments. White House spokesman Harrison Field said that many presidents have promised, but none other than President Trump has delivered to actually make government more efficient and root out waste, fraud, and abuse in Washington, and that mission is moving full steam ahead. Doge no longer appears central to that mission. Trump has told aides he is over Doge's aggressive and, at times, reckless tactics, according to people familiar with his comments. Some officials have expressed concerns about their ability to trust Doge workers who remain loyal to Musk. The White House has given agency heads more control over Doge staffers who have moved out of their home base at the General Services Administration and into federal agencies, those people said. Last month, the head of the Social Security Administration, Frank Bisignano, sought to lessen Doge's influence internally and approached the White House for guidance. The response, agency heads can decide whom to keep or cut. Bisignano parted ways with one Doge staffer from SSA, who in June moved to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, people familiar with the matter said. Officials in the Trump administration have also begun scrutinizing Doge's work more closely, including contract cuts ordered by Doge officials and in some cases stepping in to reverse them, according to a person with direct knowledge of the matter. When Musk first attacked Trump on X a month ago, leading to the real-time implosion of their relationship, some Doge staffers immediately wondered whether they were about to be fired. This is obviously beyond crazy, Davis texted an associate on June 5th, about a week after he left the government. but mission and actions remain the same until we are forced out. Davis, who has served as Musk's right-hand man at companies including X, SpaceX, and the Boring Company, has continued to speak with DOGE staffers since leaving the government. He often communicates with them over Signal and sometimes calls certain staffers multiple times a week, according to people close to DOGE. Steve is out of the government, but he's not out of DOGE. Anthony Armstrong, a former Morgan Stanley banker and top DOGE official, told staff in early June, according to meeting notes viewed by the Wall Street Journal. Musk has also talked to DOGE staffers since his breakup with Trump. At a June 10 meeting, Musk, Davis, and Katie Miller, a top Musk advisor, and the wife of White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, told key DOGE employees that Musk continues to back their work, encouraging them to stay the course. The efforts by Musk's allies to keep a foothold at DOGE have been complicated not only by White House officials, but by employees within DOGE itself. Some senior DOGE officials have expressed concerns about Davis, an outside businessman connected to the world's richest man, continuing to potentially have access to sensitive government information through his DOGE contacts. Some of them have conveyed their concerns to White House officials. Davis subsequently pushed for their firing, calling their back-channeling an attempted coup, according to current and former employees close to DOGE. Sam Corkus, a DOGE staffer working in a senior role at the Treasury Department, told people he didn't accept that Davis had any continuing authority over DOGE after leaving the government. Subsequently, Davis urged the firing of Corkus and other staffers and told DOGE staffers not to talk to Corkus, people familiar with the events said. Corkus, who remains in his role, is implementing the IRS modernization plan that taxpayers have deserved for over three decades, a Treasury spokeswoman said. Other people close to Musk are carrying on DOGE's work, most notably Airbnb co-founder and Tesla board member Joe Gebbia, who is now a senior official at the Office of Personnel Management. In late June, allies of both Davis and Musk made a pitch to White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles on DOGE's future, essentially auditioning for continued roles at the group. Their message, DOGE is moving from its destructive phase to growth mode, focusing on rebuilding what they describe as customer-facing parts of the government. Using Mad Men-style boards for a presentation, Gebbia pitched a plan for a refurbished National Parks website, among other things. Susie listened, a White House official said. There were no major decisions made. Business. WPP names Microsoft executive Cindy Rose as next CEO. Rose takes the helm on September 1. By Elena Varden. WPP named Microsoft executive Cindy Rose as its new chief executive officer, as the advertising giant faces challenges from artificial intelligence and seeks to turn the page on a string of client losses. Rose, who is currently chief operating officer for global enterprise at Microsoft, will take the helm on September 1st, the London-based company said on Thursday. The appointment ends weeks of uncertainty about the successor to Mark Reed, who in June said he would retire at the end of the year after 7 years as CEO and three decades at the company. Reed will step down on September 1 and support the transition until the end of the year, WPP said. Central banking, what division inside the Fed means for future interest rate cuts. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has sketched out new conditions that could trigger rate cuts by summer's end, but inflation remains a big question. By Nick Timorasso. A brewing debate inside the Federal Reserve over how to address risks posed by President Trump's tariffs threatens to end a period of relative unity with officials potentially at odds over whether new cost increases justify keeping interest rates high. In recent weeks, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has indicated the central bank might have a slightly lower bar for cutting rates than seemed possible this spring, when larger tariff increases threatened to meaningfully push up prices while weakening the economy. A rate cut isn't expected this month. Instead, Powell has sketched out a middle ground where milder than expected price readings or softer employment data might be enough to justify cuts by the end of the summer. a lower threshold than more obvious signs of deterioration the Fed might have required when larger tariff hikes prompted forecasts of more sharp inflation increases. Trump's announcements of larger-than-expected tariff increases in April derailed Fed plans to resume rate cuts this year by creating concerns about a stagflation scenario in which growth weakens and prices rise. In that environment, Fed officials would have likely needed to see the economy slow to have more confidence that price increases would be short-lived. Since then, two developments have animated a possible shift. First, Trump has dialed back some of the most extreme tariff increases. This week, the president extended a window for bilateral trade negotiations with more than a dozen countries, revealing latent risks of a global trade war re-escalation after new August 1 deadlines. Second, tariff-related increases in consumer prices haven't materialized, though many officials and economists expect price hikes in June and July data that will be reported beginning next week. That is setting up a crucial test for competing theories about whether tariffs will prove inflationary and is inciting internal divisions over how to manage any costs if forecasts are wrong in either direction. It is much easier for businesses to absorb cost increases and avoid larger price hikes if the average tariff is closer to 10% to 15%. Than if it's the kind of levels that the president announced on Liberation Day, which were much higher, said Robert Kaplan, a former Dallas Fed president who is now vice chairman of Goldman Sachs. Because of weaker domestic demand and global overcapacity, tariffs may not be as inflationary as we fear, he said. Powell's shift offers tactical flexibility as officials study inflation and employment data over the next 3 months. In recent appearances, he has aligned himself with the significant majority of Fed officials who expect cuts this year, and he has described potential rate reductions as resuming a process that was merely put on hold when tariff risks emerged, language that suggests Powell views current rates as temporarily elevated to guard against inflation hazards stoked by tariffs. The evolution reflects an assessment that inflation risks could take longer to materialize and therefore pack less punch. If the Fed can maintain a forecast for less dramatic inflation increases, Powell could open the door to cuts by summer's end based on softer labor markets or better inflation news. Analysts say stabilization in the unemployment rate last month, hardly the stuff broad-based labor market deterioration is made of, underscores the Fed's wait-and-see posture. Kaplan thinks a July cut is too soon, but if he were still at the Fed, I would be getting myself mentally prepared to take a serious look at September, he said. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to act in September, but I'd like to get prepared. At the same time, Powell has suggested the Fed might be only a few cuts away from a neutral stance, suggesting any resumed rate reductions would be limited and gradual if the economy can avoid a serious downturn. The Fed's June meeting minutes, released Wednesday, point to two broad groups on the central bank's rate-setting committee. A sizable minority doesn't expect a cut at all this year. They are fearful that after 4 years in which inflation has run above the Fed's 2% goal, customers grow more accepting of higher prices and businesses will have greater reason to test their appetite. A larger group expects cuts this year, thinking tariff costs might not prove large enough to risk persistent inflation or that the labor market will soften or both, but most want to wait a few more months. Within this group, so far only two officials, Fed Governors Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman, have signaled their desire to resume cutting rates as soon as this month. They are the only two policymakers appointed to their current posts by Trump, who has fiercely criticized the Fed for not taking more drastic action. Waller has for months said he expects tariffs will lead to small, one-time increases in prices that won't generate higher inflation beyond this year. He was recently joined by Bowman, who had previously been much more concerned about inflation. They are ready to cut without waiting to see more data. Others say it is too soon to conclude that businesses aren't going to pass along cost increases. It's going to take a little while to see the impact on prices, said Richmond Fed President Tom Barkin in an interview last week. He cited one large national retailer that has said prices being changed in May reflect inventories purchased in February before tariffs took effect. In that world, I expect to see tariff-related prices come out in July and August, he said. For now, Powell has outlined a middle course that doesn't dismiss the transitory inflation view, but doesn't rush to embrace it. We're going to be learning, Powell said. We're perfectly open to the idea that the pass-through will be less than we think. Policy. Lobbyists revel in Trump bonanza, but ask how long it can last. Consultants try to get rich in president's second term without attracting scrutiny. By Josh Dazzi, Rebecca Ballhaus, and Maggie Severns. Guests scoop caviar, noshed on lamb lollipops, and sipped top-shelf champagne on a recent Friday at the grand opening of Executive Branch, a new club that President Trump's son and close friends started in Washington that costs up to $500,000 to join. There was David Sacks, the administration's unpaid cryptocurrency czar, who had been privately touting the club to associates. Some cabinet members came as guests, including Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Her aide Corey Lewandowski was there too. Donald Trump Jr. and senior administration officials mingled in the cavernous space near the Georgetown waterfront. Many of the city's top lobbyists said they were not interested in attending the party or joining the club, even though it might seem like a dream opportunity for hobnobbing with the most nascent administration. The price was too high to join the club, they said privately, and they worried membership could attract scrutiny from critics and Democrats, who could be armed with subpoena powers after next year's midterm elections. Others said they were concerned about the appearance of directly giving money to the president's family and relatives of White House officials. The children of Special Envoy Steve Witkoff are part owners of the club. An Executive Branch spokesman said the club has one lobbyist as a member and is an anti-lobbyist club. The spokesman said that while some consultants and lobbyists came to the opening party, most of the city's top lobbyists were not invited. The Wall Street Journal spoke to several lobbyists who said they were approached about the club. It is boom time in Washington for the influence industry, according to interviews with more than a dozen Republican lobbyists. The top 10 lobbying firms in Washington took in about $123 million in the first quarter of 2025, compared with about $80 million in the same time frame of both Joe Biden's presidency and Trump's first term. Lobbyists with close ties to Trump are having a particularly lucrative year, covering their office walls with photos of the president and expanding their offices, with some firms even turning down clients because they already have too many. Trump, who once vowed to drain the swamp, has relationships with many of the city's top lobbyists who raise money for him and sometimes bring him business opportunities. Washington is even less concerned about the appearance of impropriety than usual, longtime consultants say, as Trump finds ways to boost his personal income from cryptocurrency and real estate deals. A White House official said Trump's cryptocurrency policies weren't about his own business interests. You don't usually see the people in power marketing themselves as available and open to lobbyists in the same way as you see now, said Kedrick Payne, a lawyer at the Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan ethics watchdog group. White House spokesman Harrison Fields said the president was elected to serve Main Street, not K Street. Unlike many presidents before him, he is executing an agenda based on promises made on the campaign trail, Fields said. Beneath the bonanza, lobbyists know the clock is ticking. While the Trump administration has retreated from investigating the types of cases that have gotten lobbyists into trouble in the past, Democratic scrutiny could come as early as 2027 if the party retakes the House next year. When Democrats secured the House majority midway through Trump's first term, they mounted investigations into Trump and his aides, including two impeachment inquiries. That possibility leaves a narrow window to cash in on ties to the administration, but not so much that it attracts unwanted attention from this when the tides shift, some lobbyists said. Several described a sweet spot of making $3 million to $5 million a year, but staying off the radar. Trump's 2024 co-campaign manager, Chris LaCivita, summed up the strategy to friends. Pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. You can sleep when you're dead. How much is too much? LaCivita has signed up an array of clients, including from private equity and the cryptocurrency industry, given speeches and traveled the globe since Trump won. He earned hundreds of thousands of dollars advising a presidential candidate in Albania who lost. He also has worked for artificial intelligence firm OpenAI and helped a U.S. steel executive as they negotiated with the administration to close their deal with Japan's Nippon Steel. He is working with former Trump pollster Tony Fabrizio on at least some of the clients. But he has turned down lobbying for foreign countries. Lobbyists who do such work are required to register as foreign agents. Instead, he has advised executives on how to interact with the administration, setting up meetings and telling companies what to say without arguing on their behalf himself. LaCivita declined to comment on his work. Others do lobby for foreign clients. Matt Maurer, a former State Department official in the first Trump administration, set up an office in the Willard Hotel downtown for his firm, Valcor, and has signed several foreign clients, including Serbia, Hungary, and Iraq, and social Turkish startup Getir. Maurer said the biggest uptick in his business has been Americans looking for Trump's administration to help them abroad. Another firm with longtime Trump allies, Tactic Global, opened an office just down the street from the executive branch club. The two aren't affiliated. One of its partners, Barry Bennett, admitted last year to illegally failing to register an advocacy group he set up on Qatar's behalf and agreed in a deal with the Justice Department that he wouldn't undertake foreign lobbying work until July 1. The Trump administration dismissed the case last week. As that expiration date approached, Bennett said in an interview that he had flown 379,000 miles this year to Guyana, Suriname, Panama, Argentina, Paraguay, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Bosnia, and other countries looking for business. The firm already represents Vietnam and Argentina, and Bennett said he expected to ink other contracts soon, especially over Trump's trade agenda, on which countries facing tariffs are seeking Washington advice. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.